Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 18th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, starved bacteria and their resistance to antibiotics, a new approach to finding anti-malarial drugs, and the science and economics of dam removal. Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is a major roadblock in the treatment of infections. Scientists have long known that bacteria starved for nutrients, and thus not growing actively, resist killing by virtually all antibiotics. But why? In a new paper, a team led by Dao Nguyen of McGill University finds a possible answer: an increase in defenses against oxidative stress when nutrients are scarce. By tweaking the mechanisms by which bacteria sense nutrient limitations, also known as stringent response, the team was able to reduce antibiotic resistance in some bacteria in infected mice. As lead author Dao Nguyen explained, this technique is far from the clinic, but could eventually aid in improving antibiotics, especially for bacteria that occur in so-called biofilm communities, where antibiotic resistance has emerged as a particular problem.
So this research is really about understanding how bacteria become tolerant to antibiotics, meaning why can't we kill the bacteria even when they're not actually genetically resistant? And so this question really came from two observations, which was, one, a number of infections, particularly chronic infections, are very difficult to treat and are persistent despite appropriate therapy. And the other observation, which has been long-standing, is that starving bacteria are resistant to antibiotic killing. So this research is really to find out whether the responses to starvation lead them to be protected against antibiotics by regulating cell oxidative stress.
And so when you say starved bacteria, how exactly does that happen? And what are the nutrients that we're talking about that they're not getting?
So the bacteria can be starved really in a number of different ways. So if you think of it from the point of view of an infection, they can be starved if, let's say, they're confined in a particular space and then run out of nutrients. So if you think of an abscess, for instance, in a chronic infection, if you take just a test tube in the lab, they can run out of nutrients once they've used up everything in the tube. And experimentally, certainly, for instance, for this paper, you can starve them artificially just by using analogs of certain amino acids. And finally, they starve also when they're growing in biofilm, which is a big focus of the paper. And the biofilms are these clusters where bacteria are embedded in a matrix, and then the cells are confined, the cells that are confined to the inside of the cluster will be starving. And we think that happens because the nutrients might be used up by all the outside cells before they can reach the inside, or certain nutrients might be limited in how much they can diffuse through the clusters. So depending really on the conditions you're looking at, different nutrients can be lacking. And if you look at the research of other researchers, they have looked at iron or oxygen, which are specific nutrients, for example.
So then when you were moving on to the experimental phase here, you were particularly interested in a regulatory mechanism in bacteria called stringent response. Can you just tell me about how that works and sort of what attracted you to it in the first place?
Sure. Stringent response has been around for decades now, and it's a global response that you can see in the vast majority of bacterial species and even actually in plants more recently. And what we know about the response is that as the bacteria senses starvation or occasionally other environmental stresses, it produces an alarm signal called PPGPP. It's a phosphorylated nucleotide. And this allows the cells to regulate a vast number of genes, which then allows it to better adapt and survive in response to starvation and stress. And so we became interested in the stringent response because nutrient starvation was really the common condition that led bacteria to become tolerant to antibiotics. And so since this stringent response was a protective mechanism turned on by starvation, we wanted then to explore whether it conferred tolerance to antibiotics. And from the perspective of the bacteria, you can probably just think that antibiotics are simply one more type of stress that they need to cope and survive from.
So when you were actually testing this, you took some bacterial colonies and some of these biofilms that you mentioned, and you measured their responses to antibiotics under a variety of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the specific bacteria you used and how you manipulated them in this experiment?
So we did most of the studies in a species that is a human opportunistic pathogen called Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And we did this because it's really a model organism for biofilm studies, for chronic infections, and that's clinically relevant. And with Pseudomonas, we used a variety of lab strains, some genetically engineered mutants that were lacking the stringent response or were lacking the ability to synthesize these HAQ molecules, which are the molecules we've attributed pro-oxidant effects to. And then to make sure that it was just not an effect seen in lab strains, we also used Pseudomonas strains that were isolated from patients who had chronic infections and cystic fibrosis. And then we engineered mutants in those clinical strains so that they didn't have the stringent response. And finally, just to explore whether this was something seen across multiple species, we also looked at E. coli. And then, as you mentioned, you know, we tested the antibiotic tolerance in a variety of different assays. And the gist of it is simply that we grow the bacteria in a variety of different ways, in biofilms, in planktonic culture, which simply means that they're suspended in a broth. And then the bacteria would be challenged to a variety of different antibiotics. And the tolerance is the measure of how readily they're killed. So after an antibiotic challenge, how many are still alive? And in terms of how did we manipulate the response, one really key question we had were how to tease apart whether the starvation, which conferred protection, was because the cells had stopped growing from starvation simply, or whether there was actually some sort of active response. And to do that, we had to artificially starve the cells by using an amino acid analog. And the beauty of this system is when you use this analog, both the wild-type strain, which has the stringent response, and the mutant one, which does not, will stop growing. And then finally, as part of manipulating all these responses, we also had a variety of other engineered bacterial strains where we would knock out biosynthetic genes for the HAQ, as I've mentioned, or we would engineer genes so that they could restore the stringent response or change the levels of the HAQ molecules. So there was a lot of genetic manipulation in order to tweak the experiments.
So essentially, what you had here with all of these different strains of bacteria was you had those, you know, in which the stringent response was activated, and so they knew that they were being starved, in a sense.
Yeah.
And those in which it was inactivated, they didn't realize that they were being starved.
That's correct.
So what was the difference? What were the differences in responses to antibiotics?
So the main finding that we had was that although both strains could be starving, only the ones that could actually sense and then signal the starvation, meaning that they could make the signal PPGPP, would be the ones that would be tolerant to antibiotics. And so this, to us, meant that these were active responses. And what we subsequently found out in terms of the mechanism is that the stringent response does this by regulating oxidative stress in the bacteria. And at least in Pseudomonas, it does it by curtailing the production of toxic pro-oxidant metabolites, as well as turning on some more of the protective oxidative defenses. So you can think of it as like a balance, regulation of oxidant stress and oxidative defenses.
And so it's one thing to do these sort of studies in you know, a petri dish or a test tube in a lab, but it's another to sort of get these responses in living creatures. And so you actually tested some of these bacterial responses in mice. What were the results there?
So we used mice to try to mimic some infections, which, of course, you know, it's still somewhat artificial. But in these mice experiments, we found that when the bacteria was lacking the stringent response, this improved significantly the efficacy of antibiotics. So specifically, if you infected the mice with the stringent response mutant, the one that lacks the stringent response, the antibiotics was much more effective at reducing the amount of biofilm bacteria. And also, it would actually protect the mice and lead to their survival after antibiotic infection, when otherwise, with a normal wild-type bacteria, the mice would die even if you treated them with the antibiotics. So the idea is that even in animal infections, the outcome or the efficacy of antibiotics might be improved if the stringent response was inactivated.
So I imagine there could eventually be some really important clinical applications of this. So what are the next steps? What will it take to get there?
Well, of course, you know, right now from this paper, we've just identified some broad strokes of what the mechanisms are involved. And we still really don't understand which oxidative defenses are the really critical ones or which metabolites are the toxic ones and why they're toxic. But ultimately, understanding a lot more of the exact molecular or chemical mechanism is the goal that perhaps you could find a way to exploit this starvation response in such a way that if you disrupted the stringent response, somehow you could sensitize the bacteria to currently available antibiotics, just simply taking the drugs that we already have and make them work a lot better. So I think we're still working on figuring a mechanism so that maybe you could manipulate it as a form of adjuvant therapy.
Okay, well, Dao Nguyen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dao Nguyen and colleagues write about antibiotic resistance and starving bacteria in this week's Science. Another report and a related perspective article in the same issue also look at the role of antioxidant strategies in bacterial antibiotic resistance.
Most antimalarial drugs target malaria stages that have reached the bloodstream. A team of scientists this week describes a technique to target malaria in its hepatic stages, the stages in the liver, where the malaria first gains a foothold before moving into the bloodstream, and where it may hole up for months or years after initial infection. By using high-throughput computational screens and image analysis to identify promising chemical scaffolds for antimalarial drugs, the team was able to zero in on a series of compounds that prevented malaria from developing within liver cells in mice with a single oral dose. Senior author Elizabeth Winsler spoke with me about the findings and their implications.
So our hypothesis was that blood and hepatic stages for the malaria parasite were metabolically very different from one another, and that while many drug candidates can be used to alleviate the symptoms, many of them might not actually clear infections from the liver. And therefore, what we did was we developed a medium throughput assay to identify chemicals with activity against malaria parasite hepatic stages.
Hepatic stages being the stages actually in the liver.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, perhaps we could step back a second here and just talk about the Plasmodium parasite and how it actually gets a foothold in the host and, you know, to perhaps cast a bit more light on why you were looking at the liver in particular.
Right. So, as you know, malaria is transmitted by the bite of anopheline mosquitoes. And when they bite you, they release thousands of these forms called sporozoites into your bloodstream. And about 30 minutes after you're bitten, these sporozoites are able to migrate to your liver. And once they reach your liver, they form schizonts eventually within your liver. And some of these may go on to form a productive symptomatic malaria infection in about, you know, 6 or 7 days. But in the case of some species of malaria, they can exist in the liver for weeks or months or years. And unless you can get rid of them, there's always a danger that, you know, that malaria will come back. So with most drugs, you give someone a drug, it makes them feel better, it gets rid of their blood stage infection. But with some forms of parasites, the infection can be hidden in the liver stage.
And so you needed to get at the liver form of the disease in order to maybe stop the malaria from recurring, or say, or something like that.
Right. Well, that's our long-term interest, is to find candidates that will be in particular effective against Plasmodium vivax. This is the parasite that's found throughout Asia and South America, as well as parts of Northern Africa and so forth. And this is the most problematic one. But in general, we wanted to find compounds that would be active against all stages, because I think the bar has been raised in terms of trying to go from, you know, just reduce malaria to trying to eliminate it.
And so I guess your approach then was to say, well, we have these compounds that are known to be effective against the blood stages. How do these do against the liver stages? How did you go about that analysis?
So we developed a medium throughput screen, and the way that we did this is we used existing information that suggested that you could get these rodent parasites to invade hepatocyte cell lines that are expressing a CD81 receptor. And basically all we do is we incubate these sporozoites, which are fairly laboriously dissected from the salivary glands of mosquitoes, and so we have to sit around each week and pull the heads off of mosquitoes to make sporozoites. And then we put the sporozoites in the wells with the hepatocytes and different chemical compounds. And then the challenge is that only about 1% of these hepatocytes actually get infected with malaria parasites. And so we developed a high-content imaging script to analyze the pictures that come from taking micrographs of these microtiter plates.
So in essence, you've developed an imaging technique that lets you sort of go through these large volumes of experiments quickly and get the statistical results that you need.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what we did. You know, if you were to look at one or two compounds, it would be feasible, but looking at thousands of compounds, you obviously need to automate this process. And the team worked together to develop a series of computer algorithms that could go through and look at these images and identify microtiter wells that contain compounds in which parasite growth was substantially affected.
So you have a powerful new sort of lab and analysis technique here. What specifically did that analysis lead you to in this case?
Well, ultimately we found that our hypothesis was correct, that most compounds that we knew to be active in blood stages weren't really having that much effect on the malaria liver stages. And you know, this was frankly suspected based on other people looking at known drugs. And ultimately we found a number of series of compounds. They were related in that they would have activity in liver stages, and then we went on to develop some of these a little bit.
And one interesting thing, at least to me, as I read your paper, is that you were focusing not just on these specific compounds, but also sort of the type of chemical scaffold on which the compound was hung. Could you explain just what a chemical scaffold is and why you were particularly interested in that?
So a scaffold is a core chemical structure onto which different functional groups or side chains can be attached during the drug development process. The scaffold we ended up focusing on is an imidazole piperazine, which we sort of knew was active in blood stages as well. The imidazole piperazine is basically two fused cyclic rings, a midazole and a piperazine ring fused together. And what we found is that there were various members of that family that had that basic core structure within our library that were all active in the liver stages. And therefore, that gave us statistical confidence that this scaffold family was probably doing something special in the liver stage.
And so you went a bit further there and used one of these scaffolds to develop a drug candidate of your own.
Right. This is a scaffold. I can't really take that much credit for it. We've been working with a really talented team of chemists, and we're getting support from the Medicines for Malaria Venture and the Wellcome Trust, and organizations committed to ending malaria. And the imidazole piperazine family was one that we noted had the potential to both give symptomatic relief and also provide prophylactic protection. And therefore, the group has synthesized a number of molecules, some of which look very good in animal models for malaria, and we'll work with the various funders and the Novartis Institute for Biomedical Research to determine ultimately if the scaffold series is suitable for clinical trials and whether it compares well with other compounds in development in terms of safety and efficacy.
So you have an interesting drug candidate, you have an interesting lab technique for further study. Where does this leave us in the sort of larger picture of the battle against malaria? Recently, I think we've seen a number of interesting results in various approaches to attacking malaria. How does what you're doing sort of relate to the large effort of attempting to eradicate this disease?
Well, you've probably heard a lot about the vaccine approaches, and those are important, though I would say there's more history in terms of chemoprophylaxis for malaria control.
So something like quinine would be in that sort of chemoprophylaxis example.
Right, quinine or chloroquine or antifolate drugs which were really very effective in reducing the burden of malaria until resistance became a problem. And the fact that the parasites do become resistant is why we want to keep new things in the pipeline, so we don't have a resurgence in the number of cases like we had in the late 1990s when chloroquine resistance became such a problem. So it'll take a few years for these things to wind through the pipeline, but even if, for example, the imidazole piperazines turn out to not be the best candidate for whatever reason, the long-term goal is to have created sort of chemical toolbox, and we have released all of our data to the community. We're putting it up on ChemMBL, and so other people can pull these scaffolds out. They can look at them. They can begin to work on them. And the other thing that we can do with them is that we can work backwards to try to understand the biology of malaria hepatic stages. So we've been developing chemical biology ways to take a compound and to try to identify its target using reverse genetics. And so hopefully, even if a drug doesn't come out of this, we'll have created a series of chemical tools that can be used to understand hepatic stages.
Elizabeth Winsler, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
You can read the paper by Elizabeth Winsler and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
Dams, hydroelectric or otherwise, are everywhere. According to a News Focus article this week by Science's Robert Service, the United States alone contains around 2 million dams. But as the costs to maintain them rise and decades-old licenses expire, more and more of them are being removed, which can be financially and environmentally costly. Service spoke with me about the benefits and challenges of dam removal from his office in Portland, Oregon.
The history of dam building in the U.S. largely came with settlers, and it evolved over time. So with the early white settlers in the East Coast, they built dams, you know, for power sources, for flour mills or textiles or myriad different things. And then in the 1900s, as electricity came to the fore, they built power-producing dams. And so as settlers moved west, the power-producing became increasingly important, and then irrigation, because in the western part of the U.S., they needed water throughout the summers when it doesn't rain in large part. So there were lots of different needs for dams in different regions and then in different periods. So today we have approximately 80,000 dams in the U.S. These are just the ones that are over 10 feet high, or about 3 meters high. And there's been another recent survey that looked at all sort of obstructions in rivers and counted over 2 million in the United States. So there's a lot of them out there.
Indeed. And so today, what has brought dam removal to the fore, and at what rate are we tearing them down?
Well, compared to those numbers that we just went through, the rates are not very high. So the number of dam removals is now at about 60 per year, and that's up from about 10 per year about 30 years ago. So it's definitely an increasing trend, and part of the other thing that is changing is that they're beginning to tear out larger and larger dams. So as removing dams began to be more popular, a lot of those removals took place in the East Coast and in the Midwest, and were for a variety of reasons. As the infrastructure ages, it just costs money to keep it up, as well as if people aren't going to keep them up, then they become a safety hazard and can be a big safety hazard. So Pennsylvania, for one state, has made a real effort to take out dams that they have considered a safety hazard. So that's one main reason. Most dams in the United States are privately held. So these are just on private property or privately operated. And private dams are regulated by an agency called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or it's also known as FERC, and you get a license to operate a dam from FERC for up to 50 years. And when those licenses run out, you have to reapply for a new license. So as these licenses come up for renewal, operators of dams have to comply with existing laws, environmental regulations, and doing so can be quite expensive. So this is a big issue in the West right now, because the states out here are grappling with salmon populations that have been declining for decades. So current regulations require operators of dams to install fish passage to allow the fish to swim up and around the dams. And that can be an expensive proposition. So if those fish ladders or other types of things to allow fish passage aren't already existing and aren't already built, it can cost tens of millions of dollars or more to put those in. So unless you've got a dam that's generating a lot of revenue, it doesn't always make financial sense to relicense the dam. So you're finding a lot of power companies and other operators that have dams that are coming up for relicensing are now looking at that equation and trying to see what makes the most sense, whether to keep the dam operating and pay for all the upgrades or to just have the dam removed.
And so, you know, removing a dam sounds like a particularly sensitive activity. I'd imagine you can't just bring a wrecking ball in, knock it down, and call it a day. What sort of considerations need to be taken into account when tearing these sorts of things down?
Well, dams are a little bit like politics. It's all local. That's what matters. So behind each dam, you can get things that build up over time. Certainly sediment will build up, you know, the silt and the rocks and stuff like that that normally would just wash down the river. So if you just, like you say, blow a hole in the dam and let it come out, well, then all that stuff could wash just right down the river and cause problem for fish or, you know, change the path of the stream or what have you. So people have to study that and take that into account. And another major thing people need to take into account is possible pollutants that are behind the dams. A few years ago, there was a famous case of a dam called the Milltown Dam in Montana on the Clark Fork River that had a lot of mine waste and tailings behind it, and they ended up taking that dam out and have had a lot of trouble since with that pollution as it flowed downstream. So those are just a couple of the considerations. Certainly cost is another big one because it's expensive to tear down dams. You know, it's like any large infrastructure that's been built in this country. As it reaches the end of its life, who pays for that to come out? And I don't think there's been really a national discussion of that to try to do that in a systematic way. You know, one fallback has been Congress in certain cases has stepped up and said, okay, we'll pay the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to take out this dam or these couple few dams or something like that. But with 80,000 dams out there and lots of them aging and needing to come out, it's not clear that Congress is going to be in any kind of position to spend that kind of money to take all those out.
And in your article, you talk quite extensively about a few particular dams in Washington state that seem to have sort of become poster children for recovery. So what are the ongoing efforts up there, and why is it such an important site?
Well, there's two particular dams that are coming out right now, and they're on the Elwha River in Washington. The Elwha River sits on the north part of the Olympic Peninsula, almost where Puget Sound dumps out into the Pacific Ocean. And historically, it was a very productive salmon river. It's a short river. It's only a little over 100 kilometers long. But historically, it had close to 400,000 salmon a year would return there to spawn. In fact, there's great stories about early settlers there that when they were living alongside the Elwha River, they were unable to sleep at night because the noise from the fish slapping their way up the river, as well as bears crashing down through the forest and cougars coming. It was a giant smorgasbord. So
wow.
It was a very productive river. And so in 1913, a power company at the time built the Elwha Dam. And then 14 years later, in 1927, they built another dam called the Glynis Canyon Dam. So there is no fish passage on these dams, and so they effectively cut off salmon migrations upstream of the dams, and the salmon runs have now gone down to just a few thousand below the dams. Now, just upstream of the dams is the Olympic National Park, and so most of the Elwha River sits within the Olympic National Park. That's all highly pristine territory, beautiful habitat for salmon spawning. And this has been a long fight to get these dams to come out. It's gone on for decades, and now it's actually happening. So a lot of scientists are very eager and have been eager for some time to study the Elwha as it has existed over the last couple of decades and then compare it to what happens as the river begins to recover as the dams come out. So the dam started coming out in September, and now the lower dam, the Elwha Dam, is now free-flowing. Most of the dam is removed already, and there's a lot of sediment there. They try to stabilize it as much as possible so it doesn't wash downstream. And then the Glynis Canyon Dam is on its way down. It's already got these big notches in it with lots of water flowing over it right now, and soon it will be gone. So the question then becomes, you know, how does this river recover? And so a lot of folks are interested in studying that. This is now the second largest ecological restoration site in the United States behind the Florida Everglades. So it's kind of a big deal, and lots of folks are watching it and watching and waiting to see what happens.
So do researchers think that there's a happy ending for all of these restoration sites?
a good chunk of the story is about the good news of dams coming out, what that might mean for the recovery of certain species such as salmon. However, there's another side to the story that's more disturbing, and it's other long-term trends. And so there's two other main long-term trends that really threaten salmon in particular, but lots of other aquatic species. The first of those is climate change, and the second is ocean acidification. So rising air temperatures cause rising river temperatures. That alone is bad news for salmon, particularly when you get over a certain threshold in water temperature, normally around 21 degrees Celsius. It's very hard for the salmon to survive at all, and even below that, you can get lots of stress. So the other real danger to the salmon is a process called ocean acidification, and this is a very big problem for salmon because, at least now, much of their diet in the ocean for juvenile salmon is little, very tiny sea snails called pteropods, and the pteropods are already showing signs that they're struggling to build shells with the rising acidity levels. So as these acidity levels increase even more, the question then is, will the salmon have anything to eat when they're born? So those are two big trends that in the long term are threatening the salmon, even though for now the salmon are facing some perhaps welcome news with the tearing out of some of the dams that have stopped them for nearly a century.
Well, Robert Service, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Robert Service discusses the science and economics of dam removal, as well as the greater environmental threats facing salmon, in a News Focus article this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with a look at some recent stories on our daily news site. Well, first, Dave, finally an explanation for a very old observation about trees.
Right. Well, Stuart, this observation actually comes from Leonardo da Vinci, who a few hundred years ago, he observed that a tree's trunk almost always grows so that the total thickness of the branches at a particular height is equal to the thickness of the trunk. So in other words, if the trunk splits into two branches, if you take the cross-section of those two branches and add the diameters together, you're going to get the same diameter as you would the trunk. If those two branches split into more branches and you add all those branches all together, the cross-section of all those added together will also equal the trunk, and so on and so forth.
So kind of a fractal pattern.
Exactly.
Here.
So this was an interesting observation, but for the longest time, researchers couldn't figure out why trees followed this seemingly very strict mathematical rule. And one theory was maybe it was most efficient for the tree to pump water if it followed this pattern, but nobody was really sure.
And so now some people have put together a different model?
Exactly. Or? So this new model comes at it from sort of a different angle. And the researcher here sort of imagined a tree as a series of cantilevered beams, the beams sort of being the branches. And as you said earlier, he incorporated this idea of fractals as well, the idea that, you know, something gets split into parts and becomes smaller and smaller and smaller through infinity. And he plugged all this stuff into a computer simulation. And what he found was that what made the most sense, the reason that trees seem to follow this rule, is because following this rule helps them resist wind breakage. If trees don't follow this rule, the branches can splinter, the tree can actually fall down. A lot of bad things happen. And for some reason, when trees obey this precise mathematical rule, that doesn't happen.
And so Leonardo's formula just kind of falls out of this model?
Exactly, exactly. It's a really good fit, actually.
Are there any applications beyond just the interest of this showing the reason for that?
Well, researchers say that it could actually help them model storm damage. In the recent Hurricane Irene in the U.S., a lot of trees fell down. In fact, even one in my neighborhood fell down and crushed a few cars. And researchers say that by knowing exactly what sort of wind forces can affect trees and how they can affect trees, it could really help our understanding of wind-based damage.
And next, something on how worms make sure that their diets are healthy.
Right, Stuart. Well, this story is about how worms learn. And it's not maybe the kind of worm you're thinking of. These are actually really tiny worms. They're known as C. elegans, and they're a very popular model for laboratory study. These worms are just about a millimeter long, so they're pretty much microscopic. And the worms tend to eat everything in their path. but some worms are pickier than others, which suggested to researchers that these worms, even though they only have a handful of neurons compared to our hundreds of millions or perhaps billions of neurons, that they have a way of learning. And this new study is all about trying to figure out how these C. elegans worms learn.
And so how do you determine something like that?
Well, what the researchers did was they took a variety of strains of C. elegans and they plated them on a plastic dish. And this dish also had some kind of nasty bacteria known as Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And these bacteria not only make worms sick, they actually make us sick as well. And what the researchers found is that most of the strains, when they put them on this plate with the bacteria, the worms would sort of go up to the bacteria, maybe take a little bite, and then just quickly move away. But there was one strain of worms that just kept on eating. And so these worms were kind of like the slow worms of the group. They really didn't seem to be learning that they shouldn't be eating these bacteria. They just kept on eating and they actually kept on dying. And the researchers wanted to figure out, well, what's the difference between the worms that are learning and the worms that aren't learning?
And so what makes a good self-educating worm?
Right. Well, it turns out it's a gene called HECW1. And this is a gene that's involved in the worm's nervous system. And it also seems to be expressed in its sensory neurons, which would make sense if it's involved in learning and perhaps interacting with the environment and things like that. What they found was that the worms that were sort of slower on the uptake had mutations in this gene, and that may explain why these worms just kept on eating when they really shouldn't have and really weren't learning from their mistakes.
I suppose, though, that there's such a thing as being too picky.
Right. And so the whole question here is, why did this one strain of C. elegans evolve this slow learning ability in the first place? And it could be it doesn't encounter toxic bacteria like Pseudomonas in its environment. And you can imagine it's not really a good idea for a worm to be picky unless it really has to. If you're really picky, you're really going to limit your food options. But if you don't have to be picky, like this one strain doesn't have to be, then it's kind of nice to be an omnivore. And so there is a reason for some worms being slower learners and some worms being faster learners.
What about organisms bigger than worms?
Right. Well, it's a good question. And a lot of people ask, you know, why are scientists studying these tiny microscopic worms? What on Earth could that tell us about ourselves? But in fact, because worms have so few neurons, they actually only have about 300 neurons, and we have 300 million times that, they're a very simple system to study these sorts of things. And if we can figure out the genetic basis of behavior in a worm, it could shed a little bit of light about what's happening in our own brains.
And finally, the news that I, at least, have been waiting for most of my life, looks like a tractor beam might actually be possible.
Right, Stuart. This last story is about new progress towards developing a real-life tractor beam. And this is actually a story that deals with four groups of physicists, all who have independently come up with an idea for a tractor beam that would actually work. And when we say tractor beam, for those that don't know, we're talking about...
Those that don't know.
Right. There are a few of them out there that haven't seen Star Trek or Star Wars. But basically, a tractor beam is, you know, ostensibly this beam of light that would lock onto an object and pull that object in, kind of like a tow truck with light. It's an interesting concept, but obviously very tricky to pull off. Although scientists have made some progress toward this. In the past few decades, they've used light to push objects. Believe it or not, light, even though it doesn't seem like it's able to do this, can actually generate force. It's like the world's tiniest blast from a water hose.
I can understand that light would have some force associated with it, all those little photons pushing against something, if you will, but I'm having a little trouble envisioning how it might pull an
object. Right, exactly. It's one thing to push and it's another thing to pull. And what this new research involves is tweaking the light, and in this case, it's a laser beam, tweaking it so that it actually adopts a pulling force. And what you basically have is in an ordinary beam of light, as you said, Stuart, each photon moves in the direction of the beam. But what these researchers proposed is creating overlapping light waves that would make an angle relative to the desired direction that you want these objects to move. And these overlapping waves would produce a forward-moving beam, which is known as the Bessel beam. But in this beam, each photon is actually moving at an angle relative to the beam, so that when one of these photons bounces off an object, it exerts a small forward push. Now, we're still having push here. And where the pull comes in is the researchers can actually tweak the properties of the object so that it actually becomes polarized by the light. The object changes electrically and magnetically, and the polarized object will then radiate and redirect the light. And by adjusting the material properties of the objects and the polarizations and the synchronization of the individual light waves of the beam, physicists can make the object radiate more light forward along the beam than backward towards its source. Now, this all sounds very complicated.
So they create a little, but it's like creating a little retro rocket, actually.
Exactly. It's like creating a reverse thruster. You can actually see sort of a diagram of what this would look like on the website.
Well, I guess one thing that's interesting here is that you have four separate labs converging on the same idea.
Exactly. And they all have various little tweaks on the idea, and some of their ideas work better for certain types of objects, and some work better for other types of objects. And you can actually look at the story on the site to get a sense for how all these groups differ. But it's the same basic idea.
Well, how big of an object are we actually talking about pulling here?
Well, unfortunately, Stuart, your dreams of seeing something pulled through space may not actually materialize anytime soon. We're not talking about something as big as the Millennium Falcon or the Starship Enterprise. Right now, this would probably work with something about the size of a grain of salt.
Oh.
So you're going to have to wait.
Breaking my heart.
I know. You're going to have to wait a little bit longer for a bigger object to be pulled around by light.
Okay, Dave, so what else are you looking at for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story on synesthesia. This is this interesting neurological disorder where some people see a number, but they also see a color associated with that number that other people don't see. Also, a story about reconstructing a 47-million-year-old moth, trying to figure out exactly what it looked like and what colors it sported. For Science Insider, we've got a lot of stories this week about the 2012 U.S. budget. What's going to happen with agencies like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and other agencies, and how their budgets will impact science in the U.S. and elsewhere. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Alive is about the science of storm chasing. We'll have a couple guests on. We'll talk about what it's like to fly a retrofitted warplane into the heart of a storm. So be sure to check out all of these items on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org. Where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the November 18th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.